You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 210, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. We're in the process of gearing up for a whole new slate of interviews in the weeks to come. In the next few episodes, you'll be hearing from brand new guests like Keith DeCandido, Anthony Taylor, Barry Reese, Jim Beard, Josh Reynolds, and more, as well as your old favorites like Mark Busquet, Bobby Polite, Jim Yelton, and Mark Finn. Topics in the weeks to come include Dragon Con, Space 1999, The Rook, Warhammer 40,000, Zack Snyder movies, Iron Man, and Conan, just to name a few. And this should turn out to be a classic run of episodes of the show, and I can't wait. In the meantime, this week we're presenting a special episode where the tables are turned and I am the interviewee. I was recently a guest of Dr. Art Sippo and Rick Croxton on their great ongoing podcast, The Book Cave. They have graciously allowed me to bring you some of the highlights of that episode here. In it, they ask me about the most recent Sentinels book and about the new military science fiction series that I've recently begun, among other topics. You can find The Book Cave at thebookcave.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. Or just Google The Book Cave, and it should be the first thing that comes up. So, without further ado, here are the great Dr. Art Sippo and the great Rick Croxton interviewing me, Van Allen Plexico. Enjoy!
Van is an author of some of the very best superhero novels ever.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, well, what can we say? Why don't you give us a little background on the Sentinel series, and then tell us where Metal Guard fits in.
Okay. Well, the Sentinel series, I started back in 2005, 2006, and I've done pretty much a book a year. There was one year we did an anthology with some other authors, too, called Alternate Visions. But the series proper is now seven volumes, and I write them in trilogies, with sort of the first volume setting up the problem and often sort of dealing with the immediate problem, but the bigger problem is still lurking. And then the middle volume usually kind of escalates the tension and ramps up the crisis. And then the third one is usually where everything falls apart and there's a giant battle. And, you know, if there hadn't already been a giant battle, there's a huge battle and everything kind of comes down to hopefully a kind of a surprise twist ending and all that. And along the way, I try to do lots of character development with an increasingly growing cast of superheroes and supervillains and aliens and, you know, cosmic characters. It's sort of my, the Sentinel series is basically my entire Marvel universe of my own. With everything from like the Kree and the Shi'ar to Galactus type beings, Celestials type beings, Thanos, Kang type beings. You know, I don't have my own copies, but they're sort of, you know, analogous in a way, I think. And I think you said very, very correctly, in my opinion, that Metal God does kind of lower tensions down just a little bit, and that's intentional. I wanted to sort of, with this new book, take a breath, kind of catch up with what everybody's doing, because the second trilogy, books 4, 5, and 6, were so big, so cosmic. You know, the Earth nearly got eaten four times over by Galactus level, you know, a giant sentient Death Star and a living sun and all that. And so there was a lot of fallout that kind of came from that. And so while this book does introduce the new crisis, it also kind of takes a breath and lets lets the reader sort of catch up on what's sort of happening back at home in the headquarters and in elsewhere. So
very good. Yeah. Now, your major character in the Sentinel series has been Ultra.
Yeah.
He's out of commission there as everything starts.
For a while, he has been. Yeah, I believe it was in they all kind of run together to me. It's one big story. But I think it was in Volume 5, World Mind, that he finally was kind of – at maybe the end of 4, beginning of – or somewhere in 5, he was sort of put out of commission, at least temporarily. And what this has really enabled me to do is bring the other two major characters even more to the forefront and put more of the responsibility on them. It's sort of like if Captain America was back in the ice, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then Iron Man and the Wasp sort of have to step forward and lead two different divisions of the team. And one of the things I was really proud about, the way that Stellarax Volume 6, the ending of the last big trilogy, I was proud of the way that played out, even better than I had hoped, was that I think that it provided opportunities for both Pulsar and Ezra Brakus to really show leadership, to step up and do things that even they probably wouldn't have thought that they could do, because Ultra was the superhero. Ultra's the one that's always been a hero. Everybody knows him. He's like Captain America or Superman. And Pulsar hadn't been doing this for very long. She was a college student. And Ezra was a scientist, an inventor. And so both of them have had the superhero world kind of thrust into their laps. And they, you know, we've had to kind of had to watch and see how they would react without Ultra to lean on. Mm-hmm. And so certainly in the new book, you're in the position to start out with where, I won't say too much about it, but at the beginning of the new book, you're kind of in a position where Pulsar Lynn is on Earth, really needing to put a new team together because it's fallen apart after Stellarax. And she's having to sort of deal with being the leader of the team on Earth. And meanwhile, Ezra Brakus has gone off across the galaxy with the, basically my version of like the Kree or the Shi'ar, to deal with a situation there. And so he's kind of off on his own, more or less, having to deal with sort of cosmic outer space menaces. And they both are really being tested and being put in a position of having to show their stuff, you know, show what they're made of.
Your first book starts off that Lynn, you know, becoming a hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's just breaking in, and you see that she's being groomed for greatness. That's obvious in the first story.
Well, and she goes through fire. I mean, she really is tested from the very beginning. That's the one thing that people usually comment about. I won't ever give that away to anybody that hasn't read it. But there's stuff that happens that she's involved with in that book that really sort of from the very beginning, she's, you know, she knows that she's in a different world and is going to have to deal with some things. Yeah, I mean, I guess just the overview would just be that Ultra has always been around. He has a mysterious past, but he's been around for a very long time. And he essentially is a secret operative for the Defense Department, for the United States government. And he's publicly known as a hero. In fact, doesn't even have a secret identity. He's like if Superman, if there was no Clark Kent, and all Superman did was just work for the government. And in the first book, he sort of hooks up with Ezra Brakus, who is a millionaire inventor that wants to be a hero but hasn't ever really had the opportunity, and with Lynn Lee, who is a teenage college student who has sort of mutant powers that we still haven't completely discovered exactly why she has them. Her little sister does too, but that's a little bit later on. And so the three of them kind of form an unofficial team. They never, in fact, that's one of the running jokes through the entire series, is that they're never actually called the Sentinels. There's a Project Sentinel that Ultra kind of runs, but they're never actually called the Sentinels except on the cover of the book. And I even referenced that in the new one. In the new one, somebody says something about the Sentinels, and Lynn's like, what are the Sentinels? She has no idea, right? But certain other characters kind of get pulled into it as well. And so by the end of the third book, you pretty much have a 5, 6, 7, depending on how you want to count it, person team loosely together, and they've faced a couple of big menaces and saved the world, but the door has also been opened that there are even bigger menaces on the way. And so then in the fourth, fifth, and sixth books, that's sort of the cosmic trilogy, where the sort of Galactus or celestial level threats show up at Earth one after the other. And in those books, it doesn't seem like there's any possible way that these little earthbound, you know, superhero characters could ever face off against these giant space gods. But they find a way, of course, you know, as you can probably imagine, since there's a seventh book, to they find a way around it, more or less. And so that menace sort of goes away for a while. And now in the new trilogy, like I said, the events of a Galactus-type story take their toll. And so now in the new trilogy, things are kind of settling back down into a new status quo with some new members showing up and new situations, and some of the old situations kind of becoming more tense than they were before. So what am I leaving out that probably the reader would need to know? Bruce, what do you still need to know?
Well, no, I think you've given me a pretty good idea here. So basically, if I start at the beginning of the books, you introduce characters as we go. I mean, I did start reading the beginning of this latest book, and I was like, whoa, look at all these characters. My gosh, I need to know about these people, you know? So the fact that you do start off introducing characters one by one or you know, a couple at a time, I think that's a great thing because, yeah. I mean, I can't say I've never jumped into the middle of a series and kind of figured my way out backwards, but if I can start at the beginning, hey, you know.
Well, yeah. Think about it like it's a superhero story, but it's like a comic book in novel form. So it's like if you started out by picking up Avengers number 48 or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's going to be all these characters that got introduced earlier on or in other comics, and, you know, and you can go back and start from the beginning, or you can just kind of jump in with both feet and try to figure it out as you go, because that's certainly how I did comics when I was little, and I figured it out soon enough. So that's kind of what I was trying for.
And you do start off the seventh book with a little I don't know if that's quite a character rundown of all the characters that are in the book.
But, you know, it's interesting. I remember way back when, I'm one of those people who's old enough to remember way back when, when the original Galactus series came out with Stan Lee. That was probably the biggest single event in the Marvel Universe. We had, because everybody got involved. The Fantastic Four were involved. You had the Avengers involved. Everybody was involved. Mm. And, you know, you've been a fan of, you've been a fan of the Marvel Universe since then. And, you know, there's definitely, you know, in reading your work, there's been an awful lot of influence from the way that universe originated and how it's played out. What do you find intriguing about that, the universes you've got with, you know, with the Galactus level beings and all that?
Well, you know, that's a good question, a good point, Art. The thing that always appealed to me probably the most about something like the Marvel Universe was how you could have a little bit of everything. You know, you could have the detective, you could have the Batman or Spider-Man level, Daredevil level character, you could have a Norse god, you could have a Greek god, you could have a guy in super high-tech armor, you could have mutants, I mean, you could have aliens like the Kree and the Skrull and everything. I mean, one of the things that's so great about the Marvel Universe is its sheer scope and diversity. And so, with my books, I don't want to get all that in there because honestly, a lot of what Marvel's layers are made of is different writers over the years in different series doing variations on the same thing. And I think you really only need one of anything a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't need 15 different cosmic beings. I only have, you know, three or four at the most. And, you know, you don't need 15 different street level characters. I have two or three maybe at most, but it's that idea of being able to have so many different almost so many different subgenres all represented within one universe and interacting with each other. You know, it's like the old scene where you'd see the Avengers flying off into space to confront Thanos or something, and Spider-Man and Daredevil would be sitting there on the top of the building going, yeah, we ain't getting involved in that. Good thing we got these guys. And it was so neat to get different perspectives like that on the same story, you know. So that's the kind of thing that I think is I like and am trying to sort of get the feel of, you know, recreate the feel of.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old, remember the old Green Lantern, Green Arrow?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going off to space and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, that was the influence as well. Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Because, I mean, Green Arrow, I mean, yeah, I like those stories and all, but he didn't really fit, you know, in it like a space style.
And it's interesting when you put Ezra Brakis in that kind of a situation. I mean, you know, this is a guy that it's kind of neat because in one book, I guess in the first book, they go to the moon and Pulsar, you know, Lin Lee is just astonished. And Ezra's very lackadaisical, like, oh, yeah, I've got a moon base. We can go to the moon, no problem. Well, then now you turn the tables and he's on a spaceship going across the galaxy and having to be taught basically the language through injections and stuff. And so now the table's turning. He's all wide-eyed because somebody even more advanced than him has come along. And so it's just neat to play with the perceptions and the reactions of these characters, especially once the reader really gets to know them and they're like real people. And I tell you what, it gets easier to write these characters every book because they become more and more real people to me. You know, every time I write them, it's to the point now that they just tell me what they're going to do. I don't have to stop and think of anything. They just go, and I try to keep up. So that's the truth.
Well, yeah, well, that's, I think a lot of writers have had that experience. You know, they create a character, and the character starts writing their own story.
Yeah, and it wasn't true at the beginning. I mean, at the beginning, I had to stop and think, okay, now what would they do? But, you know, by the fourth book, at least, if not earlier, they know what they're going to do because if they've been put together consistently, if they have rational minds as characters, then it's obvious what they will do, what they will say, who they will make a joke with, who they'll insult, who they'll feel sorry for. You know, all those things just fall into place if you've rounded them out well enough. And I mean, I do have a lot of characters, and some of them are probably a lot more one-dimensional, but I think there's a good core of relatively multidimensional characters here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can tell, you know, just reading through the stories, the development of the characters, you know, Pulsar has really developed, his sister Wendy has developed some. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that's one of the things that I kind of like about the prose versions of superhero stories. I think we do a better job at character development there than we do in the mm-hmm. comics. Comics are extremely visual. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of action-oriented stuff going on. That's what made them very appealing to kids. And, you know, there's also a lot more going on here under the surface. We've gotten a little bit better about it with the writing, I think, in the last 20 years in comics and mm-hmm. working on psyches. But, you know, the prose way, to me, is still the best.
There's just a lot more room, too. I mean, imagine how many issues of a comic it would take to do one of these books. People say, oh, you know, you're only cranking out one a year. You could be doing 12 comics. I'm like, well, I can get more than 12 issues of story into one book, though. So,
oh, yeah.
Plus, you get to add all this extra stuff in there that you don't really get to see in the comic.
Yeah.
You know, the character building. Like I mentioned several times before, I like, you know, once in a while they had, like, in the Avengers where, remember that one episode, that one issue where they just kind of trap in the elevator? And, you know, Iron Man say, hey, you know, I know we can kind of blast our way out, but let's kind of cut back on the expenses.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where you kind of, you know, it's a talking, you know, talking heads issue. You know, at least
sure.
part of it.
Well, and, you know, they
can't do it today.
Yeah, and you know they don't really use thought balloons anymore, so that even limits further how much character development you can do other than just doing like a Bendis-type all-dialogue issue, but that gets kind of dull because you don't want to read a whole comic. Like you say, Art, it's a visual medium, and if you spend the whole issue of just people going back and forth talking, that's pretty boring, but I can get that entire conversation into two pages in a novel and then get on with the rest of the story. So it is a very different medium, and it provides different challenges and different opportunities. The question I get the most often from readers is, when are you going to do a comic book series out of this? And I've really gotten to the point of saying, if you turn it into a comic book, I think it loses a lot of what makes it, in my opinion, special.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it just becomes another superhero story. Well, we do have five illustrations per issue. I can't really get Chris to do. I can't ask Chris to do much more than that. He's generous enough to do the five that he does, but it's pretty remarkable to me to think about it that he has now done 35 separate full page illustrations of these characters.
Wow!
And we're planning on doing a coffee table book of just his art when we get maybe to the end of number 9, because that'll be 45 separate pictures. And then I'll do like a little commentary and then have him do a little commentary on, like, I'll do a little commentary on what's in the picture, and then he'll do a little commentary on how he did it, you know, how he developed the angles and the techniques and everything. And we'll put that out as like an oversized book if we can. That's probably another 2 or 3 years down the road. But once we finish these three trilogies, we're going to try to do some extra stuff like that.
Like kind of a who's who of all your different characters that you have, huh?
Yeah. Oh, you know, and that's something that Bruce was saying a minute ago when we kind of had our technical difficulty, that you made a good point. You were asking about the characters and the introductions and everything. What I started doing, I think with book 4 maybe, was having a list of characters and like a couple of sentences about each one, because, you know, like y'all were saying there, by the time, you know, you do start getting a lot of characters, and I wanted there to be a handy reference where you could just kind of look somebody up if you couldn't remember exactly who they were. So I started adding that every one. And starting with the third volume, I started doing a sort of what has gone before summary about 2 pages long for the third book of each trilogy. That way, when you get to the big climax, you can very quickly figure out what's happened up till that point. So I don't want to do it every book, but I do it every third book to kind of clue you in on where things stand.
Well, that's good. You know, I noticed in most of the printed versions of War and Peace now, they have a little handout that does that for you.
Oh, okay.
Because Tolstoy has so many characters involved, and with all these patronymic terms and all that, they will include that so that you can remember who this person is. And I think it's helpful having that in there. You know? Now, you had said that you have further plans this year. You got 2 more volumes coming. Now, Metal God is the title of the current one. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Metal God from the title?
Okay, this is very tricky. I have to be very careful because there's stuff that goes on that I don't want to spoil.
Right.
But yeah, very basically. I guess I'll start with the Kurbai. The big alien race that are kind of like the Kree or the Shi'ar in my universe are called the Kurbai, K-U-R-B-A-I, which my old plotting partner Bobby Pleat and I came up with. It's really basically a tribute to Jack Kirby.
Ah.
And they are red-skinned with white hair. So instead of the blue Kree, you got the red Kurbai. Okay. Well, they are like a very powerful star-spanning empire, and they've been popping up ever since book 2. And they are alternatively either kind of friendly or hostile to the Earth, just depending on what's going on. The reason – I kind of have to start with this, okay? I'll be brief. The reason they'd be hostile to us is because we keep causing trouble. Things keep happening on Earth, which bothers them. And so from the very beginning, their attitude is, let's just nuke the whole planet and not have to worry about it. So the Sentinels are kind of like, no, let's don't nuke the Earth. Let's see if we can find another way out of this. Well, the fact that the Sentinels keep finding a way out of these things is now making the Kurbai nervous in another way, because the Kurbai are now like, if these humans, as weak as they look, are able to get past all these menaces, they must be actually pretty dangerous, right? So our very success at surviving is worrying them. So that being the case, they have left a sort of a sentry robot, kind of analogous to the Watcher, okay, on the moon to keep an eye on us. And at the beginning of Metal God, another sort of robotic being lands nearby and destroys that Kurbai sentry. Now, you immediately wonder, well, who or what is this, and who or what is it working for? You are then told at the very beginning of the book, I'm not spoiling anything from past, like the prologue here, you are then told by a human character broadcasting the whole world that the Kurbi are coming to get us, to conquer us, to kill us all, oh my God, but I will defend the earth. So from the very beginning, you have this strange robotic character from somewhere called Metal God that is clearly a threatening being, but you don't know exactly who it's working for. And you have this mysterious human who claims to be able to defend the earth, and he wants to rally humans against the Kurbi. So there's a plot going on here. Somebody's up to something, but there's some double crossing, and there's some, you know, thing. Let's put it this way: things are not what they appear.
It never is in your story.
No. And if you want to kind of visualize Metal God, he's like a big sort of metal version of Brainiac, the Superman villain.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
He's kind of a big green humanoid looking robot, and he's got I described to Chris, I said, think about like those things that come out of the alien's back. Yeah. and make them weapons. And he sort of took that and did kind of a Dr. Octopus look to it. And so that's why he's got but I liked it. It looks more menacing than the way Doc Ock's look. And so he's kind of like a big mean looking robot, but then he's humanoid robot, but then he's got these extra arms that kind of come out of his back that can do even more damage. So he's a very menacing character for sure. You just don't know what exactly he's up to or who he answers to. Would that sum it up pretty well?
Yeah, that does it. And that's going to be the crux of it. Over the next couple of issues, we're going to find out more about what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really kind of going out on a limb with the next one, because I'm going to do a few things with this story that I think people aren't expecting. I'll give you a very, very vague reference to kind of what you can expect here. The most shocking thing I ever saw on a science fiction TV series probably at the time was in the third season of Babylon 5, when things looked really grim for Babylon 5, and then suddenly Captain Sheridan declares independence and the entire series changes into something else. And so something kind of like that is coming, where it just – where you just go, holy crap, I can't believe that that's happening. There's just no way he went there, right? So,
now, one of the things I've been seeing about in the series is that the Earth has been attacked so many different, you know, been attacked several times,
mm-hmm,
by all these different aliens. It's like, it looks like to me, it's like some of the governments are going to start saying, hey, we need to do something to protect ourselves. Because we got these, you know, world-devouring characters, you know, constantly try to, you know, get rid of us.
Yes, and it's not a coincidence that the final big scene in this book happens at the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
So you're on the right track, Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I've noticed is, like, in every single book, if I can remember right, you had some characters that are being introduced. You know, like in this book here, I don't want to say, but mm-hmm, there is a new character, you know, one or two characters being introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you'll have some introduced, and others will kind of, you know, no longer be in there. They might be mentioned, either killed, you know, maybe killed, or just no longer able to do stuff, or just kind of, stuff aside.
Yeah, a couple have retired more or less. Yeah, that's true. And there's been at least one or two killed. A couple have retired. It's funny because I still get emails and comments on Facebook and things from readers who say, you know, when are you going to use so-and-so again? I really miss that character. And I'm like, you know, gosh, I've already got so many that I'm trying to juggle that I can't use everyone every time. I mean, I kind of have to be like Henry Peter Gyrick and say, you know, seven of you are in, the rest of you wait for the next subplot.
Oh, yeah. I remember that cover.
Well, you know, I did that. I got to do that with Chris. If you get a copy of Stellarax, the paperback that has the pictures in it, the fifth picture, see, this was the last illustration for the second trilogy. I told Chris, I said, we've got to do the Avengers cover with Gyrick, because at that point we had everybody basically in on the Stellarax crisis. Everybody. And so after it's over, they're all sitting around the table. And what was funny was he did that picture, I think, right before or a bit before the Avengers movie came out. And so once the Avengers movie came out, I said we should have had them all eating shawarma. Because we have them all sitting around the table with Otto, the butler. Well, he's not really the butler. He's the cousin of the guy that owns it. But he's basically my Jarvis. You know, he's just a grouchy, crotchety, strange little European man who serves as the, you know, the Jarvis or Alfred role, and basically complains to Pulsar all the time. They don't get along. But yeah, I have him serving the food, and they're all sitting around the table, and it just looks like they all ought to be eating those, eating that shawarma, like at the end of the Avengers. So, but yeah, I did get to do that. That was really fun to get Chris to draw all the characters. I don't know if he thought it was fun. To draw all the characters.
Yeah, he may have felt about it the same way that Ditko did about all those spider webs on Spider-Man's costume.
Right. Well, my favorite story like that was real quick was when I talked to George Perez at a convention, and he was saying how, you know, he always draws all these extras, all these extra characters. And so he said when Jeff Johns gave him the script for the Legion of Three Worlds, Jeff just figured that scripts always had that in it. So Jeff included all those characters in the script. And George is like, there's nothing for me to add. Well, you know, and I was very fortunate to get Sarah White to be the colorist for the cover of the new Metal God cover. And I just want to say that I'm partial to the whole series, but I just feel like the cover of the new book is by far the best looking cover that we've done so far. It's a combination of, I made a new logo with more of an Avengers font, and Chris Kohler, who's my interior artist, did the cover art for the first time. And I just couldn't be more pleased with kind of a throwback vintage 60s, you know, the floating heads reacting to the battle in the middle. And then Sarah White came in to do the color of it, and I thought she just did a spectacular job. So I'm so pleased with this cover, and I'm also very pleased to be able to announce that Chris is going to do the next two covers to round out the trilogy, and Sarah is going to do the color for them. So the next, wow. So this book and the next two will have that same really butt-kicking cover art. I'm really excited about.
Outstanding. Well, now when can we expect the next volume?
Well, you know, it's amazing to think that, at least to me, that, you know, I'd been putting one out a year. And I kind of, when, Stellarax was like, Stellarax was throwing a match into the fireworks factory. You know, that wasn't just lighting a few. That book is a, you know, let me put it this way. You know, the first volume is only about 55,000 words. Stellarax was almost double that. Stellarax was 104,000 words.
Wow.
Because it was funny. I kept pushing the story back. I was working on volume 4 and I had stuff left over, and I said, well, this is a nice compact story. Let's just push that to volume 5. Okay. So volume 5, I get it together and there's stuff left over, a lot of stuff left over. I'm like, well, it, you know, this is a good story. Let's push that to volume 6. Well, when I got into Stellarax, there was nowhere left to push. So there's like 8 epilogues. You know, I always joke that the end of Stellarax is like the end of Lord of the Rings. It's so many endings, but I just felt like it needed to have all those separate epilogues to wrap everything up. But it's a huge book. And so I was worn out. And so Stellarax came out in like March or April of 2011, and I didn't get Metal God done and out until last month, December of 2012. So it was about a year and a half. But at least I did have one out the same calendar year, you know, in the next calendar year. So I didn't break my streak, but I pushed it right till Christmas. So now I'm in the middle of another series, literally in the middle of it, and I'll tell you all a little bit about it in a minute, just for a second. But what that means is that I've got one more book in that new series to write, and then I'm going to write The Dark Crusade. Volume 8 will be called The Dark Crusade. And it just will pick back up with where this one left off, and it's really all going to be hitting the fan in a big way in that one. So I'm hoping that will be out somewhere around about time of Dragon Con, maybe August, July, August, maybe at the earliest, hopefully, of this year.
Wow. Okay, so you're kind of pushing your timetable a little faster than usual.
I want to get them back to the middle of the year. I'm not thrilled with having them come out so late. Yeah, there's award season in January, and you hate a book coming out right before everybody votes because then nobody's read it, you know. And
yeah.
I mean, among other things. Plus Christmas, everybody's got other stuff going on. So, I'd really like to get them out more in the middle of the year. So, hopefully I can get the next one out a lot quicker than this one. Yeah, you know, what's going on is there's just an ongoing series of jokes in these books about names. They've been trying to name the team since the first book, and they just can't ever decide on a name. And in the very first book, there's a series of jokes where they name Pulsar and give her costume, and that was kind of embarrassing for her. And then, from there, it's just been anybody that doesn't have a nickname or code name gets made fun of, basically, and somebody tries to name them. So, yeah, somebody at one point does get called Hey You, which, yeah.
Well, now, you were talking about this new series that you've got on the books. Why don't you tell us a little about the new series?
I love superheroes, but I've also gotten really into kind of the British military science fiction, kind of like the Warhammer 40,000 type stuff. In the last few years, I'm a big fan of Dan Abnett and Graham McNeil, among others. And I believe our own Josh Reynolds writes for them. Yeah. And so I kind of wanted to do my own sort of version of that in a way where you have a far future empire and you have these big armies of super soldiers in the future. And I wanted to tie it all into my existing Lucian and Hawk universe. And, you know, if you read Lucian, it's all about these gods, but it's in a science fictional universe. And if you read Hawk, it's all about a science fictional universe where those gods from Lucian are still talked about. And so in this trilogy, which is called The Shattering, it goes back and kind of connects everything, and you find out how the galaxy got shattered in Hawk, because Hawk is in a galaxy that's been shattered by this giant apocalyptic war. And this trilogy basically is that war. It sets everything up, where these invaders came from, who they worked for, and how the galaxy got shattered. And so it's been a lot of fun because I get to go back and use some of the stuff we saw in flashback in Hawk, which was when the galaxy still had the giant armies of defending, you know, troops and carriers, spaceships and all that, you know. And that's really the fun part. You know, what I originally envisioned Hawk as this post-apocalyptic lone ranger, you know, in his spaceship. But as I was writing that book, I was having more fun writing the flashbacks to when they had a giant army before the big, you know, battle. And so this lets me kind of go back and do, you know, I guess it's almost like with the Star Wars movies, how the original Star Wars movies that are later on in the timeline are kind of, you know, after the Jedi Knights are gone and all that. But this is letting you kind of go back and do the Jedi Knights, you know. So this is fun in that way because you get to see the stuff that's been wiped out by the time of Hawk.
Aha.
So. Yeah.
But so, you've done it right compared to what Star Wars.
Well, yeah. I hope so. Well, and the first one's called it's going to be Legion 1, Legion 2, and Legion 3. The first one's called Legion 1, Lords of Fire. And the second one is Legion 2, Sons of Terra. And the third one will be Legion 3, Kings of Oblivion. And essentially it's because there's three different armies or legions, and you kind of see how each of their stories unfold across this trilogy with these different soldiers and this situation that they get into that includes both alien menaces and sort of supernatural stuff that comes out of the Lucian part of the universe, where you have gods and demons and all that getting involved.
Wow. That sounds like it's going to have a lot of interesting stuff in it.
I guess it's ambitious, but I like to try to do new stuff and push the envelope. So we'll see
now,
how.
On the Hawk, okay, you think Hawk and Lucian is part of this, right?
Yeah, I wrote Lucian years ago, and it's more about it's the perspective of a god who's kind of like a Loki type character or a Satan type character, but he's wrongly accused. And so in that book, you see that there is this science fictional future universe, But he really kind of exists within his own, you know, his own business, what he's trying to take care of, clearing his name and everything of the accusations against him. With Hawk, you saw much later in that universe what's happened after a horrible alien invasion force has come in and nearly obliterated the galaxy. And so now we're going back and seeing kind of in between there, set in between those two.
Mm. Very good. So when are you envisioning that this will be ready?
Lords of Fire, Legion 1, Lords of Fire, the series is called The Shattering. So Legion 1, Lords of Fire will probably be coming out in paperback in early, mid-February and on Kindle right after that. And then I'm already writing Sons of Terra, which should be out hopefully this summer. I'd like to put those out about 3 months apart if I can, because my books usually are so far apart, like a year apart. I'd like to try to get a series out, bang, 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 and just see if people like it better when they can get, you know, all three of them together. There's also another factor, which is that M.D. Jackson, who's a great artist, did me a cover for a combined edition, and so I can't wait to get all three done so I can later on put out the combined edition with his cover art on it. So having a cover floating around waiting is always a good incentive to get a book written.
I'll bet it is.
Yeah, well, it's beautiful too. It's the General Iapetus and the Sons of Terra. Let me tell you right quick what their deal is. Basically, you know, the deal is that you've got these three legions, and two of them are tasked with going out and fighting. It's almost like the Napoleonic War. So two of them are tasked with going out and fighting on the frontiers against the enemy. But the other legion, the second legion, is tasked with staying at home and defending Earth, defending the homeland. So they're called the Sons of Terra. But the problem is that their leader, General Iapetus, he's not a good guy. he's a fanatic, and he makes these guys into fanatics. And so at one point in the first book, one of the main characters basically says, you know, Iapetus is dangerous, he's a thug, he's uncontrollable. And the other one says, well, he's a gun, but guns can be useful if you keep them pointed in the right direction. And so that's kind of, it's very fun to write a character who's kind of a protagonist, but is also kind of a bad guy, you know. And so I think people will really like the characters in these books.
Very good. Well, so this is, gosh, you've been moving on with the Sentinel books now since 2005. So that's been a while, and we got the new series coming up. Anything else that's on the horizon that you'd like to let the fans know about?
Well, I'm kind of limiting the new short stories I take on. I've done a lot of short stories in the last 3 or 4 years for different publishers, and so I'm not really taking on any new ones for like the next 6 months to a year, just so I can get all this other stuff done. But I've turned in quite a few over the last 2 or 3, or even in one case, I think 4 or 5 years. And it's looking like several of them will be coming out. And they're all from different publishers. I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to talk about specifics, but I can say if everything goes well, and none of it's in my control there. But if everything goes well, I should have quite a few short stories and novellas coming out this year in addition to the new novels. A lot more than last year, but I also love working with, you know, Ron Fortier and Rob Davis and Airship 27. I love working with Tommy Hancock and Prose and others. And so I should have stuff from at least both of them coming out in the next few months, along with other authors, you know, other writers combined. So, I'm sure that that'll be talked about a good bit by those guys and others when the time comes. But, yeah, there should be a whole lot of me on the shelves this year. Maybe too much.
Wow. Well, it does sound like you're going to have a very productive year, a very busy year.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
You know? Well, I'm just very grateful to have readers out there that seem to like what I do. And I hope that they'll check out the new series, because it is kind of a departure in a way. I haven't really done... You know, like I said, even Hawk, which was military in a way, was still kind of superhero military. Mm-hmm. But this really is going to be more like generals and colonels and majors and special forces and in outer space kind of thing. So I hope you all give it a chance. Check it out.
Very good. Well, that sounds fascinating. The quality of your work is really excellent, and it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. I think the fans will enjoy it.
Thanks.
Now, Metal God, it was published in December.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's available where?
It's on Amazon. It's on Kindle now, I'm pretty sure, yeah. It's $2.99 on Kindle, and it's, I think, a $14.95. It's a smaller book than Stellar. Stellar actually had the price had to go up to $15.95 just because it was so much of a bigger book. I hope that the readers think they got their extra dollars worth with that one. I think that I put an extra dollars worth in it, at least. But Metal God takes us back down to the $14.95. It's on Amazon. I guess they can bookstores rarely stock any of our books that much, but you should be able to order them if you want them. So, yeah, pretty much anywhere you can get a book.
All right. Well, I guess that's kind of bringing us towards the end of the show.
Okay.
Is there anything else that you wanted to let the fans know about? This is the shameless plugs part of the program.
Oh, I think the whole episode has been, and I appreciate that. That's what I really appreciate is the opportunity to tell the readers out there. I don't like to think of myself as having fans. Maybe I do, but I just I have people who appreciate some of the stuff I write, and bless them. And I'll just tell them I always keep you guys in mind when I'm writing, all of you, and I try to write what I think you'll enjoy and what I enjoy. And if I enjoy it, there's probably some other people out there who will enjoy it. I just try to be honest to that, true to that vision. So, but just keep your eye out because there should be basically something from me every month or so for the next year just because of all the stuff that's been floating around with Pro Se and Airship and White Rocket. So,
very good. All righty. Well, I guess that kind of brings us to the end of the show. We wanted to thank Van Allen Plexico for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure. And we're looking forward to reading the new books in the series. Metal God is the first of – this is going to be your third trilogy, I guess.
Yep, third trilogy.
In the Sentinel series. And then we have the new one, Legion 1. What was the title again?
Lords of Fire.
And that's going to be coming out fairly soon. That's February, mm-hmm. March time frame.
Yep.
So, these are things to keep your eyes out for. And Van, as always, it's been a pleasure, and we hope to have you back on the show as the new material starts coming out.
Oh, all right. You guys are the best, and I always appreciate you guys having me on so much. Thank you.
Super. You're very welcome.
All right. And that was the Book Caves interview of me, Van Plexico, conducted by Dr. Art Sippo and Rick Croxton. They have a great show with great guests from all over the new pulp and pop culture world, and I hope that you'll check it out and give them a listen. Again, they're located at thebookcave.libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N, libsyn.com, or just Google The Book Cave. That'll do it for another episode of the White Rocket Podcast. Stay tuned in the weeks to come for some really great new episodes I'm sure you will enjoy. And as always, we'll see you down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.